This program is brought to you by the Practicing Law Institute, a nonprofit learning organization dedicated to keeping attorneys, professionals, and accountants at the forefront of knowledge and expertise.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. This well-known proverb was made famous when George W. Bush fumbled the saying during a September 17, 2002 speech given in Nashville, Tennessee. Mr. Bush said, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, can't get fooled again." Although the gaffe went down in history, the sentiment still holds true. This idea of taking personal ownership when being fooled a second time by an untrustworthy person was first found in The Court and Character in King James, written by Anthony Weldon in 1651. As the proverb stands, if you get fooled more than once, it's totally your fault. I thought this would be the perfect title for this book. Maybe you were deceived once, but the stories and lessons included in this book can help you never be fooled a second time. And if you do get fooled a second time, well, it actually may be your fault. That passage comes from the foreword of the 2023 book, Fool Me Once: Scams, Stories, and Secrets from the Trillion-Dollar Fraud Industry. I'm lucky to be joined today by Kelly Richmond Pope, the book's author and a leading thinker in the fraud and accounting space. We look forward to getting into her interesting career, her research as an accounting educator, and some lessons learned from Fool Me Once today on Insecurities. Hello and welcome to the Insecurities Podcast, keeping it fresh and staying wonky on the latest securities, regulatory, and enforcement developments with a practitioner's perspective on the stories you should be following. As always, I'm Chris Ekimoff, and I'm flying solo today while Kurt enjoys some time away from the microphone, hopefully with his family, but probably with some of his clients as well. As you all well know, Insecurities often has time to carve away from our regularly scheduled programming of SEC regulation and enforcement actions to focus on what some of us think is equally, if not more important, the language of business, accounting. And with Kurt gone this week, I'm so pumped to get to dive into accounting with a true leader in the space, both on the debits and credits side, as well as in the areas of fraud and forensic accounting. Dr. Kelly Richmond Pope is the Dr. Barry J. Epstein Endowed Professor of Forensic Accounting at DePaul University in Chicago. Pope is a nationally recognized expert in risk, forensic accounting, and white-collar crime research, and an award-winning educator, researcher, author, and award-winning documentary filmmaker. Pope teaches managerial and forensic accounting both at the undergraduate and graduate level. Dr. Pope's research on executive misconduct culminated in directing and producing the award-winning documentary All the Queen's Horses, which explores the largest municipal fraud in U.S. history. Pope currently serves on the board of directors for the Greater Chicago Food Depository and chairs its audit committee. Pope is a former director and finance committee chair for Mercy Hospital and Medical Center, the former director of the Illinois CPA Society, and a former member of the governing council of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Dr. Pope has earned her Bachelor of Science in Accounting from North Carolina A&T State University and her Master's in Accountancy and Doctorate in Accounting from Virginia Tech. Dr. Pope, hopefully I can call you Kelly. Welcome to the Insecurities Podcast.
You sure can call me Kelly. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I got to ask, we're in that phase here, right? The weeks leading up to a couple of large basketball tournaments across the country. I didn't see NCA&T make the tournament. I know that they are a storied track and field program among many other activities, but your Virginia Tech Hokies women are currently a 4 seed and hosting the first and second round games in Blacksburg. How do you think they're going to do over the next few weeks?
Chris, I could not tell you. I am so sorry.
That's all right. I mean, every bracket
but
is going to get busted. Right?
Go Hokies, go. That's
you
all I can tell you.
I love it. I love it. Well, let's get back.
I'll always give you my honest answer, you know?
That's right. I know. It's a popular topic, too. I won't ask you what is a Hokie, because I know there's both like a two-sentence.
It's a turkey.
That's right.
It's a turkey.
There's a two-sentence definition. Then there's, you know, some very long script that people read from about what it means to be a Virginia Tech Hokie. So
I went from an Aggie, which is a dog, to a Hokie, to a bird.
Super. So all over the animal kingdom. Well, yes. We want to talk a bit about you, Kelly. And obviously, we went through your bio. You've done a lot and been a lot of places and a lot of amazing things. I'm interested, though, you know, with our guests, especially in the accounting space, of what really got you started, right? We've got this paradigm that I believe has shifted in the past 20 years, but for many of our elder brethren and sistren still believe it's all green visor, suspenders, and counting beans. But, you know, stories like yours, I think, can really help highlight the initial interest, right, that drew folks like you and me to this profession. So what is your origin story when it comes to accounting?
Well, I took my first accounting class in high school, and it was Mrs. Farrell was my accounting teacher.
Shout out to Mrs. Farrell.
Shout out to Mrs. Farrell in Durham, North Carolina. And she is still around today, and awesome. We keep in touch. But it all started there when I took that class. So I took accounting my freshman year of high school and my sophomore year of high school. My junior and senior years, I took econ and a microeconomics course and a macroeconomics course. But I really enjoyed the knowledge that I gained in the accounting course. And I really believe, I learned it then and believed it then, but still believe that accounting really is the foundation of everything. Right. I mean, every business has to do a proper accounting to stay in existence, whether it's to raise money, whether it's to pay employees, mm-hmm. whether it's to launch a new product. So everyone has an inner accountant in them. Everybody. You just don't always know it.
I like that. And, you know, it goes from managing your checkbook at home, right, to understanding bank accounts and savings along the way. We talk about financial literacy a lot in the accounting profession and how CPAs are held up to the standard of knowing almost anything. Again, we're in that time of year where I don't know if this happens to you, Kelly, but it does to me. You get that unsolicited tax question. I am not a tax professional. I know you do not focus your career there either, but, you know, really spinning up that thought about how it is, kind of the underpinning, right, that language of business to understand.
It really is.
Yeah, to understand when revenue comes in, that's not just revenue that goes in the owner's pocket, that's paying expenses, that's saving for a rainy day, that's, you know, laying things out on an accrual basis. And I'm sure we've already lost a few listeners, but
no, we haven't.
It's good to say. And so that kind of that initial spark started in high school. And obviously, you know, all of your postgraduate studies were in the accounting field. Was fraud always a focus and forensic accounting a focus for you? Or did that kind of come upon you during your career?
So I had a student when I was teaching at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro mm-hmm. who wrote a research paper on forensic accounting. And I read it and I said, this field sounds pretty fascinating because if you think about it, it's the mixture of accounting, auditing, criminology, psychology. Mm-hmm. With the dash of just, if you're nosy, it's the perfect career.
I like that.
So I really gravitated to it. And so I started studying more about the field and then using that as a way to teach both undergraduate students, graduate students, and executives about why it matters. And so when you talk about accounting from the lens of fraud and forensic accounting, it really makes people say, oh yeah, I really understand why somebody might want to overstate their revenue or say they received more than they actually did or not include those returns and take that number out. When you talk about it from the power of manipulation and how numbers can be manipulated, I think we pull more people in. And there are so many tricks that you can do with accounting that the more you know, the better you are.
I agree. My first forensic accounting focused class in college, Darwin King, Professor King, I know you're a listener since we're doing shout outs to our mentors and educators along the way. He opened up the textbook on the day one and he said, you know, we're going to learn a lot about fraud investigation here. It's either going to teach you how to find fraud or it'll teach you how to commit fraud. I leave that decision up to you, right? So all of those tricks, you know, it's a double-edged sword. And he was obviously being a little bit callous and funny in his description. But I think too, you know, as you were talking, kind of how we reach out to people around accounting, everybody can identify in their life, whether they're an accounting focused professional or not, some of those activities, those tricks, those ideas that are on the fringes of, we don't have to get into ethics here, right? But kind of, hey, you know, I remember working a part-time job when I was in high school and the manager, was always very busy at the end of the month, right? That can mean the end of the month is busy, but it can also mean that maybe something else is going on. So as you start to pull on those strings, I think it really does, as you said, identify with people. Kind of those stories, maybe from their own life and personal experience that they can, you know, be nosy, like you said there.
Well, you know, what's interesting is everybody has a fraud story mm-hmm. and those fraud stories all link back to accounting. And how they link back to accounting is those transactions rolled up into either an income statement, a balance sheet, sometimes a statement of cash flows, depending on how complex the business is. But those two basic income statement and balance sheet, that fraud that happened to you has a basis of something was not truthful in one of those statements. And so the more that you understand those statements, the more you can start pulling back the layers and seeing how fraud happened or could happen.
That's right. Kind of that, are we representing economic reality here, or is there something else going on that kind of misses the mark? And I think too, you know, part of your career now, you know, apart from dealing with, not dealing with, excuse me, apart from teaching, right, the bright minds of the accounting future at DePaul University, you also spent some time consulting with some major corporations, some major, you know, fraud risk management, whistleblower and compliance issues at some of these businesses. Talk to our listeners a little bit about what that kind of work is, and then maybe some success stories or some lessons learned that you took or, you know, these businesses took from you based on your experience.
Sure. So a lot of times I will be called in to do a consulting project, and that might be help us develop a fraud training, a fraud awareness program, or can you take a look at our process and understand where are the internal control weaknesses that you see? Because sometimes having a person from the outside come in and review a transaction or review a process can be very helpful. Oftentimes, too, we are taking whether they're undergraduate learners or executive learners through an investigative platform we created. I have a team that we created, a company called Red Flag Mania. Mm. And so we launched these investigations. And so just imagine playing along an investigation where you just get to practice your professional skepticism and try to solve a case. And so we have these various episodes. We have three in process now. The When We Pray series, the When We Heal series, and the When We Break series. And so you go through and play along like you are an investigator, and your whole purpose is to either identify the perpetrator, identify the fraud schemes that were used, identify the internal control weaknesses that were present. We even have a tax challenge where a individual has to go through and figure out, is the individual trying to commit fraud? Is the tax preparer trying to commit fraud? Or how does the IRS review the whole total tax return? So we've turned investigation on its head to really figure out a way to train people. But so companies and organizations will reach out to me for insight and or training workshops to really help their employees understand why, how fraud can happen and why it's important to blow the whistle internally if you see it. So whistleblowing always becomes a piece of that training because I do a lot of research on what motivates people to internally blow the whistle. Is it financial incentives? Is it non-financial incentives? So sometimes just having that outside voice come in and share is very helpful. Now, when my documentary came out, All the Queen's Horses, you would be surprised the number of municipalities around the globe that reached out and said, hey, we think we have a fraud here. Can you come and show your movie and then do a private session with our board or a private session with our mayor, private session with our city council, just because sometimes when people, when you create that space for people to share, you'd be surprised what they will actually share.
It's those in the accounting profession and definitely listeners of ours know that we've all got that kind of story too in our careers where you just sat down for a regular information gathering interview with someone, right? Hey, we're trying to understand this internal control process here. Talk to me about when it works and when it doesn't. And they just, you can see on their face almost instantly, this is the first time anyone has asked them a question. And they've been waiting to tell you that it doesn't work or it's imperfect or God forbid, you know, Johnny is doing something inappropriate. And I can imagine, right, I want to talk about the movie in a bit, but like you said, creating that avenue where you've got a nomenclature, you've got a shared connection about this topic, where it's okay to come forward. I mean, and I've seen, and those of you who don't know, Kelly's done a great TED talk on whistleblowers, right? And how they've changed the course of history in certain respects, you know, from business as well as from otherwise. And really kind of honing in on those motivations and those rationales, I think really helps others who, you know, not everyone's going to change history, right? Not everyone's going to turn over the business or be the whistleblower for WorldCom or Enron or things like that. But being able to create that environment for honest conversation, I think, is a very meaningful takeaway. Apart from, Kelly, I'm sure everything that the students, I like how you said undergraduate students or executive students learn from that experience. So,
and then something that you said that I want to just also highlight, I did a research paper with my co-authors, Janet Samuels and Steve Kaplan, and we were trying to figure out what encourages people to whistleblow. And just asking a person, have you seen anything? That direct question is so powerful. that, you know, people might not willingly say something if you don't ask. Right. And so we did a whole study around that. And people, you know, if you ask me, I'll tell you. If you don't ask me, my lips are sealed. I'm not saying anything. So that whole idea of really having superior interviewing techniques is so important when we're doing like fraud investigations and information gathering.
You got it. So always ask that question, right? Well, I want to talk a bit about the movie. I don't know many, and I'm sure you might know of one or two others who are CPA slash filmmakers, right? It's not your average slash, you know, combination. So hopefully there's one or two others out there. If not, you know, many of us will be trying to get films made in the years to come as Hollywood bounces back after the summer of Barbenheimer. But speaking specifically about All the Queen's Horses, that came out in 2017, and it focuses on a single employee in Dixon, Illinois, who embezzled almost $54 million over a 20-year period. If you could, just give us a brief rundown of the case, its discovery, and maybe the implications of Rita Cronwell as the name of the employee, her crimes, and maybe the fallout.
Well, Chris, you just summarized it. If you really think about it, you know, that's small town. Dixon's population is, well, back then, a little under 16,000 people. So small town USA. And as you already stated, their city comptroller embezzled $53.7 million over 20 years in plain sight. And what did she do with the money? She bought horses. Hence the name All the Queen's Horses.
That's right.
But what was really fascinating to me about All the Queen's Horses was, or the Dixon fraud specifically, is the environment. Because what, as I was watching at a distance in Chicago, because Dixon's about 3 hours west of Chicago. And as I was watching, what was interesting to me was how people were focused on Rita as the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And what I was focused on and why I did the documentary was, what was the environment that led a person to think they could steal this amount of money? There must be some significant internal control weaknesses. There must have been just blind trust. Like, let's go and talk about this environment and take a look at it. So that's really what I wanted to expose, because the Ritas of the world are not uncommon. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is a person that is at a very important position that you unconditionally trust. If you ask anybody in any organization, you go up the ranks, someone has that go-to person that once they tell them something, they never check up on it. And that's who Rita was. And so she was able to exploit the type of trust that people had placed in her. And so many organizations have people like that. So I was fascinated by the environment of Dixon. Like, why would someone do that? You think about any of the listeners that have kids, and say you have a teenager, and the teenager takes your Porsche out for a joyride one night. What was the condition that allowed them to think that was okay?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, the teenager is going to be a teenager, but what was the condition that allowed that to happen? So I was really fascinated with trying to understand what was going on in Dixon. And I wanted to shed light on that and just learn more about why a person thought that they could do it, why a person could get away with it for so long. And that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So that was where some of my curiosity started.
I would encourage everyone to please watch the documentary. I believe it's live on Amazon Prime right now. So Amazon Prime members, you could go over and click now, not during working hours, obviously. Be sure to take care of that job. But, you know, I think what's interesting too is the discovery. Right. And it is almost that classic case of employee who has that level of trust, as you described, the readers of the world being away, and a very mundane task that the person taking over for them, you know, just calls a bank and says, hey, can I get the listing of accounts so I can update them this month? And there being some information there that they didn't expect. Right. One or two other accounts that were previously unknown to those within the city that then kind of unraveled a lot of that information. So it's, I like to think not only about Rita and her activity and the kind of the fraud triangle, right? The motivation and the rationalization, the opportunity we talk about ad nauseum, but kind of the, I go back again to what you said up front, right? Being nosy, right? The individual who called the bank for those accounts could have said, nah, I don't need those extra two. Just give me the ones I asked for, right?
And on some of the bank confirmations, the secret account that Rita was using to embezzle was listed there. So what was the environment that allowed everyone who saw that to say, I'm not going to look into that? And so that's really, as an educator, what made me say, we really need to be training the next generation of leaders in the field to really understand what fraud actually looks like. because when you think about the hierarchy of the profession, in most professions, accounting, law, you know, the people that are doing some of the most important work are some of the most inexperienced, you know? And so when you have this pyramid structure, the people at the bottom, you know, your first years, your second years, your third years, those are the ones that are in the trenches going and digging. Do they know what fraud looks like? Maybe you had a junior level person that was on that bank confirmation rotation and they just completely overlooked it.
And that's how it
was able to be perpetrated.
It wasn't on their checklist, right, to get done. And I know checklists get a bad rap. They are a useful audit tool for a variety of reasons, but not thinking of being nosy and asking that question can keep something like this going for 20 years, right? You'd have to imagine originally when the account was stood up or when it started being utilized for these nefarious purposes, someone had the ability to review that. And I think that focus on environment is interesting. Anything to kind of take away, right? I think we can all point to that and say, yeah, they should have looked more. But any of the other unique conditions you saw while getting the documentary made?
When I was going back and forth to Dixon, what was I thought was interesting was how the town was upset, but they weren't angry enough as far as I was concerned. Yeah. They were really like, she did it, it's over, you know. So it was a really interesting vibe that I was shocked at first when I saw. And then I think that the pandemic benefited some. And when Rita was released early, you know, I was shocked. So like, I was just shocked because I didn't see that coming.
Is she, and I know you probably haven't kept up to a significant degree, but I'm guessing she's not living in the palace that she utilized her embezzled funds with at home confinement or?
No. Yeah. The last I heard, she was living with her brother, but her home and all those assets were seized by the U.S. Marshals. And now she's not back in that house, but she's back in Dixon from what I heard the last. So.
Got to be a strange town to return to after, you know, all the notoriety, I say facetiously. I just want to talk briefly, Kelly, too, about kind of what's it like to make a movie, right? These are not skills that maybe you've been flexing since your time at Virginia Tech, right? How did you feel about maybe getting behind the camera or influencing some of the editing decisions? You know, how did that process go?
So interestingly, going through a PhD program is very similar to making a documentary.
Wow.
And you might not think that because with what you're learning to become when you go to any PhD program in any discipline is you're learning how to be a researcher. And a documentary is a visual example of research. So in the research process, when you're working on a paper, you're asking, you know, what is my research question? And then what are the hypotheses that I'm going to establish to test or determine if this research question is valid or not? So a documentary, going back to the paper. So then you think about what data do I need to pull or collect to support or refute these hypotheses? A documentary is very similar because you're asking yourself, what is it that I'm trying to figure out? What is it that I'm trying to uncover? And so for mine, that's called a log line. And so I was asking, how does one person steal $53 million without anyone noticing? That's the question that I wanted to answer. Then when I think about the data that I needed to collect to answer that question, who do I need to talk to answer that question? Now, the toughest part about documentary filmmaking is you can only share the story that people are willing to share with you. So one of the criticisms that I received through the process was we didn't talk to her family. Well, I can't make her family talk. Yeah. You know, if my brother stole $53 million, my lips are sealed. I'm not going to be on anybody's interview, right?
Yeah.
So but it's very similar. And I think we often have more transferable skills in places than we don't realize. You know, like you would never think that an accounting professor could also do live TV on WGN TV. But actually, you can, because we're constantly in front of people. We're constantly thinking fast on our feet. Students are asking questions. You have no idea what the questions are ahead of time. So all of that prep prepares you to do other things. So I think the documentary training is what helped me, or maybe my PhD training is what helped me with the documentary. The documentary training is what helped me with writing my book, Fool Me Once, because every little nugget is transferable to something else.
That's right. I want to get into kind of the idea for a book. Is that something that always you had? I mean, you've obviously published a lot of research, right? And your PhD work and as an academic, but in terms of what I would think creating a piece of popular media, although I don't know if that's how it would be filed in any bookstore, you know, where did that instinct come from? Did you always know these collections of stories were going to make for a decent book, or did you want to kind of go forth and put something new out there?
So one of the frustrations that I've had as an academic is our research is very limited, meaning mm-hmm. we talk to each other.
Right.
And so I always wanted to make sure that my thought leadership was exposed to a much larger population. And so the documentary was my first entree into that because it's a way that you can scale a thought.
Right.
Well, a book is another way to scale a thought. So I had been doing so many interviews with people all throughout the years. And I said, you know, I should probably put this in one nice, neat place.
Yeah.
And that was Fool Me Once. So someone asked me just yesterday, okay, what's your next book? I'm like, I don't know that I have anything more to say right now, but it wasn't something that I would say has always been in my spirit, but it's because it's not something that accounting professors do.
Right.
You know, other disciplines write books. Mm-hmm. But accounting professors tend to not write books mm-hmm. and get them published by Harvard Business Review Press.
That's
like
right.
That doesn't happen. So, but I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. And if you are going to write a second book, I think the title's already written itself. Fool Me Twice. You know, it would be, not to suggest
that. That would be fool.
We could talk about the royalty arrangement for that intellectual property.
That's sure right, Chris.
But I want to focus in. You say kind of accounting professors don't write books. But when I read, it strikes me as such a illumination of some of those tenets of accounting that we utilize every day. Every section of the book is broken up into a meaningful subset of ideas, and every subset of ideas is categorized in a way that helps delineate between shared characteristics of these individual schemes or people or victims. You know, the focus on the fraudsters themselves, the perpetrator section is broken down between three groups: intentional perps, accidental perps, and or righteous perps. And I like that and or because some of them, you know, overlap a bit, but if you could share with our listeners kind of the differences and maybe the nuances between intentional, accidental, and righteous perps.
Mm-hmm. Great question. You know, what I started to notice over the years, because we have perpetrators that come to class and speak to my students and share their stories, and that's really the stories that are included mm-hmm. in the book as well. And intentional perpetrators are intentional. They know the internal control weaknesses. They exploit them for personal gain. And those are the stories that we really gravitate to because
right.
they're interesting.
Yep.
So that's what we're watching on Netflix,
that's
and Hulu,
right.
and Amazon Prime. That's what we're watching. That's the Rita Crunwells of
exactly.
the world. That's what we're watching. But we don't always identify with them because I would never defraud my company. Like mm-hmm. I see weaknesses all the time, but I'm not going to figure out a way to go on a shopping spree based
right.
off of them. But accidental perpetrators and righteous perpetrators, I wanted to create categories where people could potentially see themselves. So an accidental perpetrator is a people pleaser. They are a team player. They are someone that follows their boss's or superior's orders and they don't push back. They might feel like something seems wrong here, but I'm going to trust the process. I'm going to trust the system. And so they don't tend to receive direct personal gain, but they could find themselves looped into a fraud and they didn't know that was going to happen. So if your boss said, you know, I just need you to sign this. Don't worry about the details. I'll inform you later. You're just going to do it because it's your boss. But you could be signing away your life. You could be. Then the righteous perpetrators are your rainmakers. They are the people that walk in your organization and they have halos over their heads because maybe they're your top salesperson. Maybe they're the person that manages the highest client. So they tend to be powerful and they have privilege within an organization and they can bend the rules and they do that to help someone else outside the organization. So they tend to do it based off of helping someone, mm-hmm. but they're still breaking a rule to do it. So that's the righteous perpetrator. So your people that are moving up the corporate ladder that have a little bit more power tend to be what I would classify as righteous perpetrators.
And each of them are so different. But also, right, it comes back to the same ideas, right, that we get back to.
Well, they're so different. And what I think we find in the media are stories of intentional perpetrators.
Right.
And so the reason why we can always say, oh, they're terrible, I would never do that. we don't hear a lot of the stories about the accidental perpetrators. You don't hear about the person who got, who just followed the boss's orders and then found themselves in just in this dilemma. We don't hear a ton about those, but we need to talk about those, because if frauds were ever to happen to a professional listening to this podcast, they would more than likely be an accidental perpetrator or a righteous perpetrator before they would be an intentional perpetrator.
Yeah, it's that 80-20 rule, right? 80% of our attention goes to maybe the 20% of folks who are doing this on purpose, evil from the outset, versus those who are wrapped up in something. Just, you know, just we'll make it up next quarter, right? That's something you hear about all the time, is we'll just, we'll move this estimate now and we'll make it up next quarter. I'll say, spoiler alert, generally, we usually don't make it up next quarter when that happens. So I like, too, that Fool Me Once, which came out in 2023, doesn't just look at some of those classic stories, but you pull in a lot of recent discussions, including things like COVID relief funding that has been such a headline issue, both in its administration as well as in some of the efforts to rein in fraud with that. I always use the shorthand when people talk about, you know, developments in fraud over the years, that, you know, humans have been defrauding each other since the days of Cain and Abel. My guess is it won't stop anytime soon. And your book kind of speaks to that, right, of the past 20 plus years of those issues. So with that knowledge and that thought about what's coming, you know, down the road and how fraud will persist, what are some of those main takeaways that you might share based on some of the stories in the book?
Fool Me Once, today is its birthday. I want to say that. So it did come... Today is its anniversary. So
1 year on, congrats. 1 year old and still going.
Still going strong. Amen. So what I think I'm fascinated by is the evolution of how it's going to impact fraud and how it's going to impact the ease of manipulating people. The AI and the identity theft intersection is what I'm curious about, how it's going to grow and spread. That I don't see a ton written about it yet, but I'm waiting for that to be a problem, you know, a big problem, because I think technology has aided in the speed of fraud and we're not paying attention to it. We almost can't stay ahead of it. So I think that's one of the things that I'm watching to see.
I think too, right, that's something we talk about when I'm consulting with clients, and I'm sure you do as well, is people use a term like velocity or scalability. I always go back to Bob Cratchit working for Ebenezer Scrooge. If he's going to defraud Ebenezer, he's got to somehow sit there and handwrite in his little ledger on his little desk the coins that he's counting and putting into his pocket, right? You could only do so much in a day, right? He could probably only steal two or three coins a day or record that in a way. We're in a technological environment now, like you said, where intelligent and intentional perps are able to not be limited by the bounds of linear time, right? Or physical activity of pressing a key. So as we move from, you know, kind of paper reporting to computerized reporting, and then from computerized reporting to, you know, we'll all say AI, even though most of us don't know what that means yet. You know, I can imagine a world where there are individuals who are utilizing algorithms and kind of machine learning that creates an environment for, you know, siphoning off, you know, dollars and cents across a huge number of transactions that Ebenezer or that Bob Cratchit never could have thought about back in his
day. Yeah. I mean, you think about, you could probably write an algorithm to be me, to sound like me, not only my voice, but you could probably figure out to scrub everything online and create a profile and probably just go and become me, or, you know, especially...
Let's focus on you. Let's not have it happy me. Let's do you.
But, you know, like, there's so much content now about ourselves that we willingly give away. And so you think about the evolution of social media and how much we share. We share where we go. We share where we vacation. We share where we eat. We share our birthday. We share our kids. We share everything. Mm-hmm. So you think how you can take all that and create a profile of me and it not be me, you know? So I'm just sort of waiting and waiting to see where we are 2 years from now. I give it a year from now. Not 2 years, 2 years.
So that's when we'll be looking for Fool Me Twice to come out in 2 years.
Fool Me Twice will come out in 2 years. Yes.
Love it. Breaking news. Hey, Kelly, before we go, I kind of want to talk a little bit about some of the things in the accounting profession that we focus on that maybe some of our listeners, you know, may only limited be aware of or may have not heard of. You know, you have been a leader with organizations like the AICPA and the Illinois CPA Society. And one of those growing issues that has occurred in the past 5 or 10 years has been what I like to call the delta, right? The difference between the market's requirement for educated accounting professionals and certified public accountants, CPAs, and students, you know, someone that you deal with regularly, willingness to pursue careers in accounting. Now, this is not a doom and gloom, the sky is falling type idea, but, you know, we spoke with Tom Hood 2 years ago about this same idea of, you know, there being a difference between what students are gravitating towards and what the market needs. What are your thoughts being an educator and a practicing, you know, consultant in the accounting world? How do you see maybe those either expectations changing or maybe a wherewithal of students these days to be focused more on these financial issues?
Well, I'm going to go back you up, Chris, because I do think it's a situation of doom and gloom. Okay. You know, we do have a pipeline issue in the accounting profession. And you think about if you don't have people able to certify the truthfulness of financial statements, that's the backbone of our capital markets. So if you don't have people that can do, that's a problem. It's even a bigger problem if you don't have people interested in doing that. Yeah. And so I think that it's a crisis moment, I think, for the field, in my humble opinion. Yeah. You know, when you see student enrollments decline, you have to start asking yourself, why? Why is it declining? Where are they going? And I do think that there's disconnect between sometimes what they're doing in the classroom versus what it actually feels like to do it as a profession.
Right.
And I'm just, you know, for your younger listeners, adulting is not fun, you know.
Regardless, right?
Regardless, amen. You know, it's great to be an intern for as long as you can because the intern is not the real world. The world, accounting, law, finance, it's a grind. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we are seeing and we are concerned about the number of students that are pursuing accounting specifically as a field has significantly decreased. The number of students that are sitting for the CPA exam significantly decreased. Mm-hmm. That's a huge problem. And so some of our challenges, you know, I think the 150-hour requirement is one of our challenges. Yep. You know, you tell a student you have to go to school for 5 years versus four. That 1 year is a big difference because you're talking about salary. I think there's a salary issue. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to be a little bit underpaid in comparison now to professions.
Yep.
I think our busy season is not very attractive to the way students and young millennials, Gen Zs, think about work-life blend. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not going to say work-life balance, but work-life blend. So I think that we have some things that are really making it tough for us to sell this as a profession that you should go into, but we're needed. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like having a shortage of nurses. If you have a shortage of nurses, that's a problem. If you have a shortage of accountants and auditors, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we are right now. So we are really thinking of ways to stay ahead of that. We are now doing more high school outreach. We're doing even middle school outreach because we want younger and younger generations to understand what accountants mean to the world. Soon we'll be going to nursery schools, I'm sure.
With a newborn on the way, Kelly, I'd be happy to have you speak with my daughter about her future in accounting. But joking aside, I think that you are one of those voices. I mentioned Tom Hood earlier. There's dozens of leaders in our profession who understand the problem and are able to translate the attractiveness of a life in accounting as a human, as well as the value to the markets that, you know, can create a lot of interest and self-actualization for students who grow up to be professionals. I won't say they grow up to be adults because not all of us actually grow up to be adults. We're still a large children, at least in my case. But, you know, you talked earlier about your drive to reach a broader audience. And I think the topics that you cover and the manner in which you present them are doing a yeoman's effort to get us to a place where we can talk to students about things they care about and then kind of slip in a little accounting message at the end of it. That's really the underpinnings here.
Yeah. You know, I think it's accounting is a means to an end, you know, and so what I hope that I represent to students and working professionals, even those that are thinking about changing out or even changing in to the field, is you can do a lot with the degree.
Right.
You can do a lot with the training. There's not this profile that you have to stay. It's a foundational skill. It's like learning how to swim, you know, and that's how I've always talked about accounting. It's a skill. It's something that I respect the knowledge that I received and I cherish that knowledge. And I always want to grow that knowledge and I want to use it. That's my superpower. I want to keep making it bigger and better all the time. So that's how I try to talk about it and try to entice people to come into it. But then they hear something called busy season and they're like, say what?
That's right.
I got to work on Sunday.
That's right.
like that. but You know, it's just part of the field.
That's it. Well, for those of you who are interested in more of Dr. Kelly Richmond Pope's superpowers, you can find her at kellyrichmondpope.com. Fool Me Once, as we mentioned, is celebrating its one-year anniversary, sold at all major retailers and bookstores. And I would encourage...
And airports.
It's a great airport read. I love the conversational nature of it. It's kind of just like you're talking to us now, Kelly, you know, sharing those stories and some of the insights, as well as some of the responses from your students when they get to meet some of these folks up front. Is definitely interesting. And I would also encourage all our listeners to check out All the Queen's Horses, that 2017 documentary that Kelly worked so hard to get published and is now part of our kind of fraud lexicon. So, Kelly, thanks so much for joining us today on Insecurities.
Thanks so much for having me. This was super fun.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Insecurities Podcast, and a special thanks to our guest, Kelly Richmond Pope of DePaul University. We always love to hear from you, our listeners. Look for us on social media to share your thoughts and comments or topics you'd like us to explore on future episodes. Please use the hashtag InsecuritiesPod on X or LinkedIn to join the conversation. You can find me at EkimoffCPA. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review Insecurities wherever you listen. Be well, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Insecurities, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. PLI is a nonprofit provider of authoritative professional services training and continuing education. In an increasingly complex business environment where intricate corporate structures reign, Insecurities can help you make sense of it all. A special thanks goes to the producer of Insecurities, Daniel Pinitz, as well as hosts Chris Ekimoff and Kurt Wolf. For more information about PLI's SEC Institute, or to view hundreds of hours of fresh and relevant on-demand programming covering changes within the security sector, visit pli.edu/membership and sign up for a privileged membership. These recorded materials are designed for educational purposes only. This podcast does not constitute legal, audit, tax, consulting, business, financial, investment, or other professional advice, and it does not create an attorney-client relationship. Please consult a qualified professional advisor before taking any action based on the information herein. Furthermore, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individual participants. These views are not the views of the hosts or their employers. Users of this podcast may save and use the podcast only for personal or other non-commercial educational purposes. No other use, including without limitation, reproduction, retransmission, or editing of this podcast may be made without the prior written permission from PLI.